At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I, B, and M. Those are the business and economy letters of the day on this Monday from American Public Media. That is A, P, and M. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Monday, everybody. It is the 20th of October today. And if you are an IBM shareholder or, in point of fact, even just an interested observer of the American technology sector today, well, it was a difficult day. IBM shares pretty much fell off the table this morning, off 7% by the close, after a quarterly earnings call with analysts that CEO Ginni Rometty called disappointing. So bad is it at Big Blue that the company has said it's going to have to scrap all of its 2015 earnings targets and completely refigure them. That is a rarity. Also, adding insult to injury, IBM is going to pay another company $1.5 billion, that is, give them money to take its foundering chip-making business off its hands. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn gets us going with that part of the story.
It's like a play on that old joke. Take my microchip factories. Please.
It's the deal of the century.
Dan Hutchison follows the industry at VSLI Research.
Now, I can understand why IBM's doing it, though.
He says the key is to look past the cash IBM is paying global foundries over the next 3 years to the chips that global foundries will be supplying to IBM for the next 10 years. That's a full decade where IBM gets the hardware it needs without running a money-losing operation.
I know $1.5 billion sounds like a lot, but it's probably a deal for IBM, too.
If you only look at the headline cash number, you are missing a lot of the story.
Rob Solomon is a professor at the NYU Stern School of Business. He says deals like this are exceedingly rare, but not unheard of.
As a matter of fact, there's another example where this happened, which was in Daimler-Chrysler's spinoff of Chrysler. In effect, Daimler paid Cerberus to take Chrysler off its hands.
Daimler could have just shut Chrysler down, but there were tax benefits, pension costs, and plain old bad PR to consider. Peter Cowan is an M&A specialist and adjunct professor at UCLA. He says that handful of pay-to-buy deals share some common features.
They're almost always manufacturing-type businesses, right? Ones that have heavy overhead, a certain amount of infrastructure, a certain amount of scale of things that need to unwind if they can't find a buyer.
In other words, costly businesses that would be even costlier to shut down. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
We are happy to report now on the economic stimulus package that's making its way out into the American economy. Wait, you hadn't heard about that one? No, Congress and the White House haven't done anything, as you are no doubt aware. Oil is where we're at today. Cheap crude is helping Americans' pocketbooks in ways not unlike an actual stimulus package, if somehow the price of oil can manage to stay low. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Call it what you will. Crude oil dividend, discount, energy quantitative easing. Oil is 25% cheaper since the peak of the summer. And for drivers, the stimulus is instant. Ed Herz in Houston is energy economist at Hill House Resources.
Every additional dollar or two that you save at the pump, you can use as a disposable income right away. Now you have more money for fast food or the six-pack of beer that you've been foregoing for the last year or two.
Beer may not last that long, but you get the point. Now, if oil prices stay low, and many bet it will, savings add up to a $200 billion annual stimulus, estimates Citigroup. That's about the size of the congressional stimulus in 2008. Citi says the global economic boost is $1.1 trillion, again, annually. Economist Stephen Brown at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, figures the typical American family saves about $40 a month.
Consumers in Washington, D.C., New York, and California, among a variety of areas in the United States, will all see benefits.
He says fortunes flip for energy producers. States like North Dakota had benefited from high prices. And global petrol producers like Venezuela are also hurting from low prices. Here's Jamie Webster of consultancy IHS CIRA.
It limits the ability to spend on some of the expensive social programs that you have within Venezuela.
But for the world's energy hogs, and that'd be us, North America, enjoy the sale price while it lasts. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not so bad all in all. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll pause for a moment here to talk about the business of politics. We are 15 days, two short weeks out from the 2014 midterms and gubernatorial races. And if you think this has been a boom time for political consultants, you ain't seen nothing yet. The 2016 presidential race is just around the corner, really. And according to the Federal Election Commission, there are already almost 900 active super PACs out there, groups that can spend as much as they want politically on almost whatever they want. You add to that hundreds of political nonprofits, 501c4s and c6s in the parlance of the Internal Revenue Service, and you got a whole lot of money going a whole lot of places. Among the places that money goes, straight into the pockets of the political consultants who set up those groups. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura explains.
A super PAC is sometimes born out of a strong sense of mission. Maybe its founder cares about gun control or education. But other times, says attorney Stefan Passantino with McKenna, Long & Aldridge,
part of that mission is to create a client for their own consulting firm.
Now, let me translate what he's saying. Political consultants can create super PACs or political nonprofits to raise money, and they can use that money to pay themselves.
Yeah, I would say it's the new growth industry.
Trevor Potter used to chair the Federal Election Commission, and he was general counsel to John McCain's two presidential campaigns.
If you're a consultant who is part of the control group that forms a super PAC or one of these nonprofits, then you get to figure out how you're going to compensate yourself, and it's not always a matter of public record.
There's a few ways this can work. A super PAC can pay a fee to a consulting firm that's run by the same consultant who started the super PAC. That firm could charge fees on ads the super PAC buys. And a lot of this spending happens in what Potter calls a black box.
It's actually pretty hard to figure out how much administrative costs many of these groups have and then how much of that is ending up back in the consultant's pocket.
A super PAC's founder can be an employee of his own super PAC. Ken Gross spent most of his career as an FEC attorney. Now he's in private practice with the law firm Skadden.
Under election laws, there's nothing improper about taking a salary out of your own super PAC.
It is taxable, however. Gross says there's also nothing improper under election laws about taking the money you've raised and, I don't know, buying a boat. Sheila Krumholtz tracks political spending at the Center for Responsive Politics.
Right now, there are 109 super PACs in our data that reported spending money but have made no independent expenditures so far.
All they're doing, Krumholtz says, is paying staff and consultants to help them raise more money.
They're capitalizing on political interests in order to siphon off money that would otherwise go to support candidates and parties, and instead they're using it for their own impersonal enrichment.
And she worries this is weakening civic engagement. It's making the electorate even more cynical. Super PACs have been around since 2010. Lawyer Trevor Potter says that one of the reasons they've proliferated is they're so easy to set up.
It has an incredibly simple one-page form you file with the FEC. You just need a treasurer and a bank account, and that's it. You're off and running.
And creating a political nonprofit that doesn't have to disclose donors, he says, is not much harder. According to Potter, because there are so many super PACs and nonprofits, political consultants are busier than ever.
The good ones used to just have a campaign or a party that they could work for. Now they have all these super PACs, so people end up bidding for their services.
Of course, every election cycle, some super PACs and political nonprofits will wither on the vine. Richard Brefault is an election law expert at Columbia Law School, and he says this highlights something even the savviest political consultant should keep in mind.
At some point, they do have to get donations.
You can start your own group, hoping it'll be a steady source of income, but you got to make sure there's money in the coffers. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Politics aside, the economy is objectively improving. Home prices are up. Consumers are mostly spending, and unemployment is down. But subjectively, it's a much different story out there. We've been asking you to tell us how your economy feels. Today, we hear from Kate Lee of Culver City, California.
I feel like one of those sailors that is on one of those 18th century sailing ships that would get stuck out in the ocean in the doldrums, those places where there's nothing to push them along, and all they can do is pray for a current or wind or something to help get them out of where they are. We bought a condo in August of 2008, and everybody was saying that's a great time to buy because the economy's rocky, but it's going to get better. And then, of course, a few weeks later, the president and the treasury secretary announced that the sky was falling. What they meant by that, which I discovered, was that actually it was my home price that was falling. In the years that followed, it's been tough. Through hard work, we came out from underwater on our mortgage, but we're nowhere near what we would need to have in order to secure any kind of refinancing. So I'm a responsible citizen, and I pay all my bills, and I pay them on time. But that means no vacations, no restaurants, no movies, no extras for anybody except our kids. And it makes life pretty dull. But it also, I know, must hurt all the small businesses around me because I should be somebody who should be a part of my community. And I'm not. I'm hunkered down in my house just paying my bills just to stay afloat. I hear a lot on the news about how the recession is improving and the economy is improving. But I'm still drifting. And I can't see any clouds in the sky. I can't see any current on the horizon. So here I am, drifting along, barely able to make ends meet, watching my supplies dwindle, and all over things I can't control. So I'm praying for wind.
Kate Lee from Culver City, California. Do us a favor, take a second and tell us how your economy feels to you. There is a spot on our website where you can do that. It's marketplace.org. Coming up,
four young kids driven by ideals, using all the great tools of modern technology to try and invent a new social network that would not compromise people's privacy.
No, come on, seriously. How is that going to go? But first, let's do the numbers. All righty, here you go on a Monday, everybody. The blue chips, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 19 points, a tenth percent, closed at 16,399. The NASDAQ gained 57 points. That's about 1.33%, ended things at 4,316. The S&P 500 up 17 points, 0.9%. 1904. IBM, we told you about already. Automated teller company NCR tumbled 21% today after cutting its earnings guidance for the year. But Apple managed to polish up more than 2% as investors anticipated its latest quarterly results. Announced after the bell, by the by, revenue for Apple did beat expectations. The energy services firm Halliburton bubbled up 0.6% today. Bond prices were mostly unchanged. The yield on the 10-year T-note steady at 2.19%. You're listening to Marketplace.
on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events coming up Tuesday. The National Association of Realtors issues its report on existing home sales for September. Coke or Pepsi? Coca-Cola hopes it's the first. The company releases quarterly earnings. And many of you may be thinking about stadium food to go along with that beverage. Game one of the World Series is tomorrow night. Giants play the Royals. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know, practically since cars were invented, car makers have been trying to make them quieter. And they did, with mufflers and better cabin insulation, which now means there is the opposite problem. Engines are too quiet. They don't quite deliver the roar that sports car drivers want to hear. So to ratchet up the sound inside the car, manufacturers are turning to the stereo system, as Sam Harnett reports.
This is a recording on YouTube from inside BMW's new hybrid sports car, the i8.
The enthusiast driver wants to hear that sound. They want to hear the engine as it's revving up.
Spokesperson Dave Butchko says BMW is known for the sound of its six-cylinder engines. But the i8 has an electric motor and turbocharged three-cylinder engine. He says they are powerful and energy efficient, but don't generate quite the same rumble inside the car. So BMW plays some engine noise through the speakers.
What you're getting is pre-recorded engine sound that is matched exactly to the engine's RPMs.
That's right. They're faking it. Lots of manufacturers do this now, with some creative branding. BMW calls it active sound design. Volkswagen, sound actor. And it's not only for hybrids or electric cars. Sean Carney handles sound at Ford Mustang, which now also does it. He says digital augmentation is minimal, only about 10% of what you hear.
It's not changing the song. It's just sort of filling in and bolstering the music that's already there.
Carney says it makes the Mustang sound more like the Mustang. Now, manufacturers have been mechanically altering engine sound on sports cars for decades. But some purists don't buy this new digital manipulation.
It's like the people with vinyl records versus digital recordings. It's not the real noise.
Bruce Jones is a professor of automotive engineering at Minnesota State University, Mankato. Sound is important, he says. It's practical, helping indicate when to shift gears, but also aesthetic, a way to perceive power. It's part of a car's brand, even a source of nostalgia.
I hear an old VW Beetle coming towards me, and I'm like, oh, wow, that brings back memories.
Despite complaints, Jones expects more car makers to go digital. He says there's just less and less real noise to give drivers the kind of experience they're paying for. In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
Cheaper, though, oil is getting. As we talked about up at the top of the program, the dangers in the oil and gas business are still high. And they used to be higher. In Wyoming, in the late 2000s, at the height of that state's natural gas frenzy, workers there were dying faster than anywhere else in the country. Task forces were convened, safety alliances were formed, all of the state's culture of safety items were investigated. And the number of deaths in Wyoming is down, but how did that happen? As part of our ongoing series, Dark Side of the Boom, Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports.
In the wood shop at his house in Cheyenne, former Wyoming Governor Dave Friedenthal is working with a slab of wood. As a carpenter, he's not really a poster child for safety.
I don't have my ear protection out here that I'm supposed to have when I use this stuff, so I'm not a very good example.
But back in 2009, Friedenthal was very much the face of the culture of safety conversation. In the first week of that year, three oil and gas workers died in Wyoming in separate accidents. One was crushed by a truck, another suffered a fatal head injury on a rig, and yet another rolled his car after leaving the drill site. Friedenthal found himself trying to answer the question.
How do you change the way we deal with safety in general in a place like Wyoming?
A place with a strong independent streak and an anti-regulation sensibility. That meant two key safety recommendations, mandated seatbelts and higher fines for workplace accidents, were basically non-starters. But there was a third recommendation from the task force convened by Friedenthal. Hire an occupational epidemiologist to study worker fatalities in the same way diseases are studied. Not an easy gig. The first person to hold the position quit after less than 2 years, frustrated at the snail pace of change.
You know, you hire somebody like that to do that job because you want them to be passionate about it. Unfortunately, sometimes that passion can cause them to be impatient with a a slow and difficult cultural change in a place that's been the way it's been since territorial days.
How slow and difficult is a matter of debate. The state's current occupational epidemiologist, Max Sewell, believes Wyoming is making progress.
I've been very impressed with the activities of the Wyoming Oil and Gas Industry Safety Alliance.
That's an industry group that holds regular meetings and trainings for oil and gas operators. Sewell provides the group with data about how workers are injured and die, along with recommendations.
I've had people come up to me and from the audience and say, this is the first time we've ever seen data like this. So I get the sense that the industry folks really like this kind of feedback.
And Sewell thinks the information is helping reduce fatalities. Fatality rates in Wyoming have gone down considerably. Today, oil and gas workers here are dying at half the rate they were back in the late 2000s. But for some, the reform push is still moving too slow.
I just have to say it doesn't appear that it's got off to a running start.
That's John Vincent, a lawyer who frequently represents injured oil and gas workers. He's still seeing workers die, and he doesn't see a big change in the culture. So why is Wyoming's fatality rate dropping?
The boom kind of shifted to North Dakota.
Wyoming's rig count today is half what it was in 2006, while North Dakota's is up fivefold. And in boom times, workers die faster. Kyla Retzer is a researcher with the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. She says there are a lot of reasons why. For one, in the frenzy of a boom, companies tend to bring old rigs back that lack safety equipment.
Also, during those times, more workers are hired, and those workers oftentimes don't have as much experience in the oil field and are more at risk.
Oil and gas development in Wyoming is once again ramping up, and already this year, at least three workers have died. But in this new boom, more people are paying attention to see if anything's changed with Wyoming's culture of safety. In Wyoming, I'm Stephanie Joyce for Marketplace.
Our series, Dark Side of the Boom, is produced by Inside Energy. That's a public media collaboration. Imagine, if you can, in this internet economy of late 2014, a social network that doesn't want your data, doesn't want to slice it and dice it and sell it off to make a boatload of money. Such a thing is not actually out of the question. It does actually exist. It's called Diaspora, and it's the topic of Jim Dwyer's latest book, which is in turn called More Awesome Than Money. Jim, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Kai.
What exactly is it that is more awesome than money?
Four young kids, driven by ideals, using all the great tools of modern technology to try and invent a new social network that would not compromise people's privacy.
They find themselves sitting around a computer lab at NYU, these four guys do, in 2010, and they say, you know what, let's be the anti-Facebook, sort of.
They said, let's build something that's better than Facebook or an alternative to Facebook. One of the boys actually killed off his Facebook account because he was so sick of the way he had so little control over what was done with his information. Another one wouldn't sign up for it. Yet they craved the social connections that you could get through networking.
It strikes me that this is a disruption of a disruption, right? If Facebook is the sort of disruptive force, or, you know, big aggregated social networks are the disruptive force in society today, these guys were trying to disrupt that a little bit.
They were trying to rewire the lines of power so that instead of going into a central server or central spot, they were held by each individual.
Interestingly, they were not able to rewire the lines of finance. They wound up going to the venture capital community. They went to Kickstarter. I mean, they needed money to do what they were going to do.
Well, that's part of their exciting story, is actually how they got going. They thought, this would be fun. Let's work on this. Let's do something for 5 or 6 months and put this together. And then they realized they were coming up to the summertime and they didn't want to leech off their parents. And they decided, well, let's see if we pass the hat on Kickstarter, which was then itself in 2010 fairly new. And they sent out word that they wanted $10,000. So within a couple of weeks, they had gotten 20. And then they ended up with a couple hundred thousand dollars and a waiting list ultimately of 500,000 people who wanted to join. So after that, then the venture capital community kind of got interested, but they could not ever actually come up with a business model apart from the existing business models that much of the web is built around, which is collecting data, aggregating data.
Is it unfair to say that this idea is kind of underperforming? I mean, we're all dissatisfied with the Facebook privacy protocols, right? And the way our data is out there, not just on Facebook, but on Twitter and every place. And yet Diaspora only has like, what, a couple hundred thousand members? I mean, it's not as big as one would think it might be.
Oh, for sure. It's not a Facebook killer, nor is it at this point an alternative for the vast networking powers of Facebook or Twitter or something like that. Diaspora was people kind of devoted to an idea, privacy, but not really connected to each other in basic human ordinary exchanges.
What do you think that says then? And this is a little off topic, but what the heck? What do you think that says about all the wailing and gnashing of teeth we do about privacy?
I think we haven't even started to grapple with how ordinary life has changed in the last 15 years. Early in the book, I quote a rabbi from the 10th century. Mm-hmm. And one of the prohibitions he made was, you know, you can't divorce a woman without letting her know that you're divorcing her if you're a man. Or you can't open other people's mail and read it. This is a fundamental human moray. And that has gone down through the ages, that people have some autonomy over what they share and who they share it with. That's disappeared with our current web ecosystem. And I think that we have stepped into this before we even realized we were boiling like the frog, you know, in the pot of water that slowly heated up.
It's a book called More Awesome Than Money by Jim Dwyer. Jim, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in keeping with my longstanding conviction that context is everything. You know how there's been all kinds of volatility on Wall Street lately, triple-digit ups and downs to beat the band? Yeah, well, consider this. 27 years ago yesterday, October the 19th, 1987, was Black Monday. The Dow was off 22% that day, 508 points. A similar drop today, just for reference's sake, 3,607 points. Yes, I know there are circuit breakers now and everything, but still, worth bearing in mind. All right, we got to go. That is the broadcast for today. The Dow up 19 points today, 10%. The NASDAQ up 57 points, about 1.33%. The S&P 500 up 17 points, 0.9%. Our daily production team is Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.